We've all felt those naked shingles on our backsides as the door behind us slams. Take the recent presidential elections, for example. We were encouraged, nay commanded, to dance with the one who had brung us. And apparently, as a nation, we did. We danced until our feet nearly... Well, that's the reality part, the next day part. The Mind's Eye writers muse about their own Circean and Orphean experiences in Romance and Reality, or In Your Face, Cupid. That's Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. O love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. That was poet Matthew Arnold from Dover Beach. We've all felt those naked shingles on our backsides as the door behind us slams. Take the recent presidential elections, for example. We were encouraged, nay commanded, to dance with the one who had brung us. And apparently, as a nation, we did it. We danced until our feet nearly... Well, that's the reality part, the next day part. There's a city in Wisconsin called Romance, where a certain breed of pig is part of the splendid reputation. And we all know how people can be turned into pigs by either too much romance or too much reality. Today, the Mind's Eye writers muse about their own Circean and Orphean experiences in Romance and Reality, or In Your Face, Cupid.
Now that I'm retired, I do the laundry most of the time, along with cooking meals.
Writer Paul Thompson.
While my wife handles car maintenance and our finances, paying the bills, hunting out the best CD rates, watching the stock market, worrying. I think I've got the better deal, especially the worrying part. Men don't like to worry. I worry about things you can't even imagine, my wife says. So anyway, the laundry. The basement, which once blazed in 75-watt bulbs, is now considerably dimmer, thanks to the spiral conservation fluorescence we installed recently. I find it a little spooky now, like a basement of dreams where a sound behind your back startles you into wakefulness. A good definition for a poem? Anyway, the laundry remains to be done. We try to keep it simple, not buying clothing requiring special handling. Although the department stores seem to think people have nothing to do except hand launder or hang to dry and lightly press or wash in cold water, you'd think we were still back in Victorian times with women laboring over wash tubs. There's still sorting to be done, of course. I wash the towels and washcloths in hot water to kill germs, most of the rest in warm, with cold water rinses for everything. And I separate light from darks, sort of. But I try to keep it as simple as possible, because life should be more than laundry, am I right? Or maybe I'm wrong and life is laundry. Keeping things clean and neat and sorted out, matching up socks and bundling them into balls, folding the underwear, hanging up the wash and wear, and having to do it again and again and again, at least for types like me who like to have things make sense, not all muddled up in the chaos nature presents. It's something romance novels don't say so much about. The smelly clothes, the brown and yellow stains on shorts and panties. If you can handle laundry, you can handle most of the stuff marriage throws at you. The sick kids, moods, struggles over the thermostat, cleaning the toilet, impassioned arguments over the arrangement of kitchen shelves, all the ambivalencies and guilt, the incarnate ordinariness of daily love. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Lady's with me now, since I showed her how to lay her lily hand in mine. Lupin lilligree, she's a sight to see and a treasure for the poor to find. Well, if I needed you, would you come to me? Would you come to me and ease my pain? If you needed me, I would come to you. I'd swim the seas for to ease your pain.
Thanks, everybody.
Here's Guy Thorvaldsen with a single sentence about love and pain.
Four middle-aged men sitting around the debris of empty plates in Nick's restaurant, all drinking beer made in small breweries, J and P smoking cigars, R cleaning his bifocals on his shirt, and then S. My soon-to-be ex is mentioned, and the good mood evaporates, replaced by the thrill of the hunt. My friends want me to talk about it, but as soon as they lean towards me, elbows rested on the greasy table like perched vultures, I know they don't want me to talk about it, the relationship. They want me to talk about her, S, because damn, we were together for 10 years, and she must have done something pretty lousy. And why not get it off my chest? Which for a moment makes sense and almost gets me on their bandwagon of revenge, because it has felt like a water buffalo has been sitting on my chest for weeks now. But one look in these men's eyes, all glazed with smoke and memory, I can see that they just want something juicy, an adrenaline rush for their sagging veins, a tale of betrayal that they can chew on and spit out. Something like last November when S accused me of sleeping around. I mean, really accused me, complete with the threat of divorce. When all the time she was setting a smokescreen, a preemptive strike to camouflage her own diddlings with Conrad. What kind of a name is Conrad, anyhow? The soil percolation expert from the DNR, where she's worked for 4 years, and where her and Conrad get sent out to do field work for days at a time. Only the fields are not fields at all, but small and big cities like Green Bay and Milwaukee and Manitowoc. replete with ground-contaminating gas stations that need percolating. And more importantly, they contain a surfeit of low-priced no-till motels, which the DNR appreciates and encourages their workers to use because it saves taxpayers a few bucks. Not that S and her soil man cared about the money, and anyway, S tells me later, it wasn't such a big deal. And certainly not about me. Just one of those things. Just happened. Didn't mean anything. But it sure as heck did mean something, and I'm sure it would mean something to my friends hovering around this table, ensuring me that talking about it would cheer me up. But of course cheering me up is not their intent at all. They instead want me to entertain them with gory, self-righteous tales of pain and backstabbing. Stories of how I rose above all that crap, dumped the bimbo who dropped me, their friend, as if from a 50-foot bridge without the bungee cord. But, and here's what the guys don't want to hear. That could have been me standing on the bridge, looking down at S falling. That the demise of our marriage was just timing. And perhaps a little more courage on her part to make something happen. And I have this vision, right there in Nick's restaurant, that at this very moment S is at some other restaurant, surrounded by an equally entertainment-starved group of women, giddy and howling like wolves, for S to dish her own dirt about me. Kick it right in my eyes, spray the bastard and run with the wolves' urine. But funnily, I imagine S, like me, is holding back, thinking that, yes, sure, she could easily talk about how I slowly clammed up over the years, and how I had my own affairs, not with other women, but with my work or with my golfing buddies, the same ones who now clamor for me to tell tales in order to validate our own negligence, that allow us to continue to nightly fall asleep on our strato loungers, to the drone of ESPN, expanding our beer and chip stomachs that expand like a dead pregnancy over our belts, and in a way over our sex, telling women that, hey, we work hard and deserve this time to ourselves, while she escapes to the bedroom to read Oprah books and fantasize about better men, more heroic, more willing to share their feelings, or at least entertain that we are from Mars and she's from Venus. But my friends here at this table don't want that, don't want to hear S's story. Don't want me to break the delicate system, that almost frantic existence which relies not on how well we are doing, but on how bad the other person is doing. And I can see as I shake my head that even though it's me suffering the heartbreak, it is my friends who are even more fearful, because right now, right here, I've decided I will give them nothing. I will send them home hungry, and worse yet, having to face their partners, who are probably, at this moment, sitting across from S, who somehow I know is withholding information the same as I. And though there's little or no hope for reconciliation, I love her deeply again, and grin and chuckle out loud and tell my buddies, no, I'm not ready to talk, and I probably won't be ready until they forget to ask anymore. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Judith Zuckerman.
Old love, our love, fine wine aged in oak vats, yet even old grapevines, pruning rejuvenates. Weathering years, life wove the fiber uniting us, yet we each blazed our own paths. Exploring Wisconsin's northern door, love songs burst from songwriters surrounded by lady slippers and Jack in the pulpit. Return home, sleep naked, reveling in the softness of your skin. Grind beans, smell fresh coffee. Run outside for the morning newspaper. I bring you coffee and the paper in bed. I love you, unsaid.
Madison poet Yvonne Yankee.
You covered the table with newspapers on which to serve me breakfast. I'm not your canary, I laughed. You're my everything, you purred in your deep soap opera voice. Bending to pour coffee into a Mickey Mouse cup, you brushed my ear with an early stubble. And for a while, everything was carnival, fantasia. Now you are just a name in the telephone directory, a number I would never call, a memory that comes back when I see yellow birds caged. Gorham Street. What comes to mind is looking across Mendota with the summer waves running with the wind, ablaze with the sun catching light, creating blue diamonds. Or in the winter when everything was frozen in place, the sun setting on the icy expanse, reaching like a red sleeve to your window. You and I looking to that beyond we never quite found. Along with the view, there was real joy, love, memories being made for years far too short. We took different boats across the water. We could not see the shore, but we knew it was there. First mate. Sorting papers yellowed with age, mementos, a letter from far away, the only love letter I saved from you. I reread it and wailed like a good Italian mother. A letter full of darlings and missing me, postmarked June 1951, Bombay, India. India was dry, you wrote, no booze, but rain falling every day. In spite of the wet, you could see funeral pyres burning from the deck of your ship, smell burning, and sometimes see a few dead bodies floating in the harbor like flotsam. You wrote in the heat of your cabin, lacing the steamy sentences with love and pretty words. How did it all end, the love letters? I can't remember how I lost you, when the letters stopped, or if the love ever did. This is Yvonne Yankee for Mind's Eye Radio.
You out there somewhere?
Madison writer Kathy Miner.
I know we said no more email, and I suspect I'm not very high on the list of people you want to hear from, but I need to say this, and I hope you'll hear me out. Okay, whatever the written equivalent of taking a deep breath is, picture me doing it now. We knew there was no future in it. Both of us did. I said to you, one of the first of those afternoons in your apartment, one day, the 10 years difference will matter. One day, you'll look at me differently. You'll see the silvering hair and the gold in my teeth and the loosening skin, and they'll add up differently than they do now. It's only a matter of time. And you said to me, maybe it was that same day, I can't ask you to leave him and come live with me. I can't say that, and I won't. Maybe you couldn't say it because we both knew it couldn't happen. So why is this difficult? Why are we surprised? Or are we? If we both knew what would happen, we just didn't know how soon. I'll tell you why I'm surprised. I'm surprised at how much I missed you now that I came to my senses and took back my ordinary life. I thought I ended it well. I truly knew when it had to be over, and we gave ourselves that one more hour together, and then, when it came time to walk out, I did it. Without clinging, without stalling, without tears, just went out the door and drove away. Honest. Clean. Over. So I'm surprised now how much I wish I could see your face across the water, across the table, across the classroom. I'm surprised how much I missed the things we did together, limited though they were. I miss tracing S for special on your forehead with my finger. I miss sharing a single thermos, alternating weeks between coffee and tea. And I miss the late-night messages. And I miss, ooh, God, how I miss, the poetry. Remember the one I showed you called Private Worship, Mark Van Doren? That third verse, the one I italicized in my copy. I knew even then it was a prophecy. She was not his to keep except the brightness flowing from her that lived in him like dew. Yeah, change the gender pronouns, and that's about where I'm at right now. We never were each other's to keep, and we knew it right from the beginning. So what can we keep? What's our flowing brightness? Remember when we used to talk about love, safely in the abstract, as in the love of all beings? I guess we just added a little more love to the world, that's all. Just because we had to stop after a while doesn't have to take away from what we put in. When you kissed me, it felt like a gift every single time. It'll be a long while before I forget that. Hey, thanks for being, and in spite of what I'm about to do, I hope these thoughts reach you somehow. Delete message without sending? Yes. Fingers on the keyboard and one foot on a banana peel. This is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio. Thank you.
Romance is sometimes more than just words and feelings. When mixed in with today's reality-based society, romance becomes an illusion we long for, yet not always knowing why. This is described in detail in Oscar Morales's poem, Romance and Reality.
On November 17, 1984, I met my first wife at a Thanksgiving food drive, where we were both stuck in a freezing warehouse in between cartons of donated food and empty grocery bags to stuff with a holiday meal. She spoke no English, but she was able to show me she was interested. That lasted 18 years, creating four beautiful children, surviving extramarital affairs, crashing headstrong into unwanted debt, before we could endure more grief or slithers of joy, we said goodbye in words that never came out. On November 17, 2002, I left my rusty key to our ranch-style home on the kitchen table, never to return. After sleeping on my nephew's couch for 3 months, I got the nerve to ask would she consider taking me back. Her response was, go rent a one-bedroom apartment, which my children later said was too small for them to visit. 4 months later, one of my sons decided to live with me. Not because I was a great father or he chose me over his mother. He liked the attention of being the only child for me to dote on. I played the part perfectly. Last summer, my ex-wife realized that her two older sons needed some changes, including their father more involved in their lives. I bought a house in a bedroom community, and they moved in with me, started life in a new high school. With three men in the house, I cook, clean, and discipline, not necessarily in that order. The freedom I was looking forward to since my divorce looks a lot more like responsibility, and the romance in my life has become a reality I have yet to get my arms around. This is Oscar Morales for Mind's Eye Radio.
James and Rhonda met at a small country school. Both thought they ran faster than anyone they knew. All the kids played tag on the playground at recess. Rhonda was the only one that James couldn't catch. James was always chasing Rhonda, so it seemed. He'd almost given up by the time they reached their teens. They had a youth group picnic, they went off for a walk, and once they started talking, they never stopped. At the Bonnet Prairie Church on Saturday, the Baker wedding will take place. The best man now will bring the ring, and joyfully we all will sing. Then dinner will be served at the Bonnet Prairie Church. They didn't move away when they finally finished school. They loved the small town nights, and they always knew they'd have a big house, wildflowers in the yard, and a couple of kids chasing fireflies after dark. At the Bonnet Prairie Church on Saturday, the Baker wedding will take place. The flower girl is Rhonda's niece. When fast. Everyone will hold their peace, then dinner will be served at the Bonnet Prairie Church. Now summer has ended, milkweed seeds are parachuting down. James is in a borrowed suit and Rhonda is wearing her mother's wedding gown. At the Bonnet Prairie Church on Saturday, the Baker wedding will take place. Rhonda's dad will have to dry his eyes when he hears you may now kiss the bride. Then dinner will be served at the Bonnet Prairie Church. At the Bonnet Prairie Church. At the Bonnet Prairie Church.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith with Janet Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Writer Esther Cameron.
In March of 1998, in a certain city which shall be nameless, a poet with more dreams than dollars made up a brochure, courtesy of Kinko's, for a phantom organization called the Hexagon Foundation, which would advocate for the construction in the city center of a building called the Hexagon, which would serve as a gathering place for local writers and an archive for their works, and would also give employment to local visual artists. The Hexagon, according to a poem by this poet, was to consist of hexagonal rooms ranged around a central courtyard. The entrance was to be a porch with seven pillars, carved with scenes from the poetic traditions of various peoples. The entry hall was also the library, with book-lined galleries tiered several stories high and topped by a crystal-pointed skylight. The building also housed a coffee house, archives, classrooms, and rooms for healing and mediation, through poetry, of course. Each of these rooms offered space for appropriate murals or carvings. A cooperative work of art mirroring a society based on mutual understanding, a romantic, a utopian fantasy. It just so happened that 5 months later, a local businessman decided to donate a very large sum of money for the creation of an arts district. A committee was quickly formed to decide how to spend the money and what the arts district would look like. Naturally, the above-mentioned poet thought she might give input. Her overtures, however, were rejected. In fact, it soon became clear that there would be no space in the arts district for writers at all. No local architect was thought worthy of the task of designing the center. An internationally renowned architect, who had designed many corporate showplaces, had to be hired, and this took up most of the original gift. The gift was increased, but the extra was quickly absorbed. Local arts organizations soon found out that their rent would increase, since none of the gift had been allocated for maintenance. That meant higher ticket prices, within the reach of fewer citizens. Some distress about this was voiced at meetings, but perhaps such things are hard to explain to people who can afford to give millions. On the proposed site of the center was a department store with a stone front in the style of the previous century. It was felt that to tear this down would have been too controversial, so the architect was obliged to include it in his design. At last the center opened, with a week of expensive concerts in the large state-of-the-art concert hall and free events by local performers in the studios. By chance, someone gave the poet a ticket to one of the expensive concerts, and she was also in one of the local performing groups. On the night of the concert, the poet and friends entered the center's grand atrium, a huge, empty space, stretching up several stories with the biggest plate glass windows ever cast, someone said. Had nobody worried about the heating bills, the energy? In writing about the building, journalists had emphasized the quantity of expensive materials used. So and so many tons of travertine, so and so many logs of such and such a wood for the veneer paneling. The paneling was pale gold. The bare floors and the carpeted surfaces were off-white, reminding the poet of a desert, actually. Before the performance, she explored the building and came to the part that occupied the space where the department store had been. And there was her crystal-pointed skylight atop several tiers of galleries. But the galleries were not book-lined, and they were accented by white tube lighting that made her think of a jukebox. It was like a distorted dream image of her dream. The same predilection for ornamental lighting was evident in the grand concert hall, where orange neon stripes accented the front of all the balconies. As one queasy about heights, the poet found the walk to her seat between many pairs of scrunched-up feet and a very low railing a terrifying experience. Settled in her seat, she looked around the hall. It was certainly big, and the organ at the back of the stage was nothing if not imposing. But why were the spotlights so much in evidence? Over the boxes hovered clusters of them, like huge black beetles. It certainly got in the way of any artistic illusion. You couldn't forget the technical means by which all this artistic experience was to be brought to you, any more than you could forget the generosity that had made it possible. The performances that evening were on the light side, serving mainly to demonstrate the much-touted acoustics. A couple of nights later, at the studio, pale gold paneling halfway up the walls, more ostentatiously technical light fixtures overhead, one of her colleagues passed the hat and netted $75 for a local high school that was having to cancel its yearly musical for lack of funds. On leaving the center, she turned to look back. There was that department store facade, elegant in its time but now, beside the white stone of the new walls, a bit dingy. Above it, through the skylight which someone had already dubbed the jello mold, she could see the waning moon. That, at least, was magical. No doubt it was well meant. Generosity is a rare thing in this world. That it should be accompanied by a grasp of the real needs of those on whom the largesse is bestowed is a great deal to ask. And money is a hard thing to control. It tends, unless carefully watched, to control its possessors as well as its recipients and non-recipients, to impose, wherever poets are not consulted, its own vision, a vision of money. The poet asked herself whether that desert of white travertine and white carpeting and endless blonde paneling could ever be made to bloom. Maybe a few murals. Would paint stick to that varnish so smooth the genuine wood felt like formica to the hand? Perhaps the hexagon could be built in that vast, empty atrium, at least a scale model, big enough to house the archives in computer form, might stand on that huge platform that seems so far intended only to keep whatever might fall from way high up on the ceiling from hitting the ground floor. Will a fairy prince of a businessman ever be found in the real world to donate a modest sum for that model? Stay tuned. I'm Esther Cameron, with a jaundiced eye from Mind's Eye Radio.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, que ça me fait quelque chose. Part de bonheur dont je connais la cause.
goods projection is the name of the old type of world maps, shaped kind of like the peeling from a skin of an orange. Fran Rahl had this sudden idea of how to look younger.
In the shower, my breasts were almost voluptuous, skin soft and firm, unwrinkled. Suddenly, I thought of hands, my hands, vain and old, softly waved across like a recently rippled shoreline. It's as though the structure is not connected to the loosely sliding skin. Could the skin on my breasts be exchanged, split with points like an old-fashioned map of the world, and attached to my hands, smooth skin laid over each finger? Telling this idea to my husband, he swiftly replied, "Just wear gloves and a deep décolletage." This is Fran Rahl slipping you some skin for Mind's Eye Radio. Poet John Morgan.
Lulu's leaving town again. Oh, the moon up in the sky seems to be asking why Lulu's leaving town again. Don't know what's the cause. She always follows her own laws, leaves jaws wagging without pause. She may be off to Yucatan or to see a film at Cannes, digging up Azerbaijan, or on a plane without a plan. Don't know what state she's in, where she'll be or where she's been, but Lulu's leaving town again. She may be in the Himalayas, in Mexico with the Mayas, or if it suits her bias, off somewhere to pick papayas. Oh, the moon up in the sky seems to be asking why Lulu's leaving town again. She was only here a week, but there's something she must seek while the bloom is on her cheek. She may be in southern France, where her life she will enhance by study of the belly dance. Foolish the heart that takes a chance. When she has to leave, she must, and we're left here to adjust, for she has the wanderlust. She may be climbing up a butte, putting on her diving suit, mushing with her malamutes, or folding up her parachute. Oh, the moon up in the sky seems to be asking why Lulu's leaving town again. She'll give you pause to ponder your heart you shouldn't squander on a gal who's born to wander. She may be tramping through Nepal, hiking the Great Wall, kayaking through a squall, or sitting in Carnegie Hall. Now she's headed west. She never gets much rest, but we wish her all the best. In Paris, dining in style, climbing Pharaoh's old rock pile, or floating down the Nile, she always goes the extra mile. Oh, the moon up in the sky seems to be asking why Lulu's leaving town again. Look now, sure as the old yin-yang, Lulu's back in town again, gang. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
Saturday afternoon romance between a cowboy and a fool a drunken meetup, a crude saloon. Rocky Mountain, a scout alive, she's no bird. And together they are two lovers crew. Got a balanced on his knee. He knows exactly what to say. You ain't been born until you get out of town. And honey, you might come with me. You might come with me. If you do. Drifters free. Gonna tangle in his arms. She's a lasting trust and fool. No man born can do me that I've sworn. A stranger, if you do, I belong to you. If you do.
It has to be over. It just has to be over.
Writer Matt Felgus.
I'm holding myself together. How can I not keep it together at work? That's why I dragged myself here today. It did what I wanted it to do. Distracted me enough to take the emotional edge off. Can't eat, though. Force it in, but not too much. Once, she was just a friend. We had a similar sense of humor and view of the world, which allowed us to talk about anything and never misunderstand the other. We could finish each other's thoughts. On a November Friday night, we were hanging out at her place, like we sometimes did, with pizza and a movie. As it was time for me to leave, she invited me to spend the night. Caught off guard, I said I couldn't, but my body wouldn't move. I stood there, frozen, for what seemed like an hour. Although tired, she stood too, barefoot on the cold tile of the entryway, waiting for me to make a decision in one direction or the other. She knew I would stay before I did. The next morning, I woke up much too early, but knew I wouldn't be falling back to sleep. She was facing away from me, breathing evenly. I wanted to reach out and touch her shoulder, not wake her, just draw her closer. My arm wouldn't move. Frozen with what? Hell, all I wanted to do was hug her. Took me so long to do it, and it was so good when I did. What was my problem? By the spring, it was her turn to be scared. She wanted me close and far away. She would refuse to see me or even talk to me for weeks. Then, just when I was ready to give up, she'd call without warning, all friendly and ready to do something fun. I tried to tell myself it didn't matter, but it really hurt. From the beginning, my friends said we were soulmates. Guess some souls should not be together. On the job today, I've thought of little else. It's ironic we both work so hard to protect ourselves, yet connect on a level I never knew existed. It's hard not to push for an explanation of how I know what I know and why her deepest secret hits me at 4 a.m. when I'm trying to sleep. I tell myself this isn't possible as I lie awake, digesting what I've seen. Flashes of a memory, her memory, a trauma from years before we met. She had never talked about this, so how could I know? I wasn't going to call, but I did. I wanted her to tell me it was only my imagination, yet she didn't seem surprised at what I knew as I stumbled with my words over the impossibility. "You made that happen," she said matter-of-factly. "No way," I sputtered. "How can I know something you never told me? It's like you sent it to me. You did it to me. I can't read your mind." "Well, you did, didn't you?" My body felt like it was buzzing when we hung up. I had a dream that she got into my bed and hugged me. My first thought was, this has to be a dream. The hug continued. I was losing myself in it. Soon as I was convinced it was a dream, I woke up and it wasn't. Then I woke up and it was. If we ever deal again, we will come to each other in strength, not weakness. These will be the last words she hears me say. Connectedly, this is Matt Felgus from Mind's Eye Radio.
That's our show. You've been listening to Romance and Reality, or In Your Face, Cupid, from the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. Our show is produced by Kelly Warren, co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski, with original music by Barbara Chusin. Today's writers were Esther Cameron, Judith Zuckerman, Fran Rall, Guy Thorvaldsen, Yvonne Yankee, Kathy Miner, John Morgan, Paul Thompson, Lynn Patrick Smith, Oscar Morellis, and Matt Felgus. For more information about Mind's Eye Radio, you can go to www.mindseyeaudio.com. If you'd like to download the show, go to www.radioforall.net. That's 4, the number 4. I'm Greg Willard, and I need more space.
I need more space.
Best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio. It serves me right for putting all my eggs in one bastard, Dorothy Parker. If all the young ladies who attended the Yale Promenade Dance were laid end to end, no one would be the least surprised. Dorothy Parker.